360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
Well, good morning and welcome to The Week That Was. And what a morning we've got lined up for you. And, well, welcome to The Week That Was, proudly brought to you by Kalano Community Association. And this morning, joining us on the show, we have got the Deputy Opposition Leader, Jared Mailey. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie. Good morning, listeners.
We've got Maddie Hepworth, our very own News Director. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Katie. Morning, all.
And we've got Natasha Files, the Minister for Health and Tourism. Good morning.
Morning, Wolfie.
I tell you what, plenty to cover off as always. I say that every Friday morning, and I never cease to be amazed by what's happened throughout the week. But the news that got everybody talking yesterday, and I guess heightened some concerns around the territory, is the fact that there's been six new positive cases of COVID-19. They've been recorded in the territory in the past, well, from yesterday, it was the past 24 hours. So five people who arrived on that repatriation flight from New Delhi on the 28th of November have tested positive. It includes two males in their 40s, one female in her 30s, and two females in their 50s. We also know that there was a male aged in his 30s who arrived on the repatriation flight from New Delhi on the 24th of November, who's also tested positive. That is on top of some of the other cases, I believe, that we had earlier in the week. Filesy, I'm a bit confused. I thought that people actually had to get tested for COVID before they got on those flights.
Yeah, Katie, they are tested before they get on the flights, and they're also screened again. And this shows us it's some of these cases are coming out, they believe, at day 6 and 7, which is unusual because we sort of thought that it was around that day 10 mark. So this virus is certainly, we know from evidence around the world, it's changing in its makeup. So, but this is why this quarantine is so important for international travellers. We had certainly built in a percentage factor that we expected people to have COVID, to be COVID positive. And we're seeing that particularly off those flights from India that they have got cases. So it's important for the community to understand that all of these cases are international travellers. There's no community transmission.
Does it put at risk, though, everybody else that's on that flight? I know that we've been told, you know, like we've mentioned, that obviously the system, the air conditioning system, the way that it filters through on planes is very different to other places. But are you expecting there to potentially be more cases from this flight?
There could be more cases. As I said, the virus presents itself at different stages, but the flights themselves, people are distanced, they're not at full capacity, they have precautions, and everyone is in quarantine. And when they're in that quarantine, they're in subgroups, not coming into contact with each other. So everyone else on that flight is still in quarantine. And if AusMat feel the need that anyone might have come into contact, say someone did present with a positive case at day 10 and they felt there might have been a close contact, they would remain in quarantine. And we've seen that in cases already.
What about the flight crew? Do they go into quarantine as well at Howard Springs?
No, not at Howard Springs. Qantas work through for those flight crew different situations so that they don't come into contact with the public as well.
Is there an increased risk for them being on those flights?
So there is, of course, a risk because they've travelled to another country, they've been on that flight. But what Qantas have done is it's very much from a safety perspective. So traditionally when we fly, we get very well looked after by airlines, and they often, you know, offer you drinks and snacks and things. What they've done on these flights is it's from a safety perspective. They're there if there was an accident or an incident, and there are items provided, as I understand, but they very much avoid the contact.
Now, we know as well that Qantas has confirmed that there is going to be additional flights for December and January. Are we expecting, how many of those flights are we expecting?
I haven't got the specific, in terms of the repatriation or domestic flights, sorry.
I thought it was in terms of repatriation flights, but I will find that info. But yeah, I thought in terms of repatriation.
So in terms of repatriation flights, the facility at Howard Springs, as we know, can house around 3,000 people. When you quarantine that, you have less availability of beds. For us, we need to make sure that we have beds available if we're to see hotspots declared, or if we're to see any cases in the territory where we have community transmission, and we'd like to utilise those beds for ourselves. So we're willing to work with Qantas and the federal government. There has been indication of doubling that to 1,000 per week, but we'll work through. The number of vulnerable Australians overseas has grown, Katie. So I think as this pandemic has stretched on, initially people thought March, April, May, we'll just bunker down where we've been caught up, where with extended family, we've got somewhere safe. This has gone on for many months. So I think people are saying, actually, this is the only way. I heard of a story, a Territory family caught up in Germany visiting relatives had done that. Young children just decided to stay put, but now they're like, we need to get home, and quarantining is the way to get home.
Oh, 100%. And I think that everybody wants to bring Aussies home. We certainly want to make sure that those Australians that need to come home are able to get home. I guess, I'm wondering, and I know from the phone lines, from what we've heard over the last couple of days, is that people are certainly a little bit more concerned about the volume of people that are now coming back, particularly by, from the perception on those flights from India that are coming back with COVID.
Can I give you the number real quick? 1,331 people have arrived on the international flights, yep, and 26 cases have been positive. So this is why we've worked with the Commonwealth. We know these people. We need to get them home. They need to go into quarantine. Mm. Sorry, Gerald, I cut you off.
So, Minister, just two things. So before these people get onto the plane, they're tested. Do you actually get the results before they get on the plane?
Yeah, so they do a point of care test 4 days before they're due to travel. And these people are identified through DFAT. So the federal government works with their officials on the ground. They work with health providers on the ground. They do that test over there. They also do a screening as they get on the flight, and then we screen them and test them on arrival.
Do any of those people get tested in their state of origin or country of origin actually get positive? And if they do get a positive, what happens then?
Yeah, so if we know that they're unwell, they're not permitted to travel on that flight. And obviously we've had numerous flights, so we're hoping that they get well and come on a future flight.
So the people get tested, get a negative result, then they get screened, then on the plane, then they arrive in Australia, and then they get a positive result.
So some of the results that we've had have had very low readings, which indicate that they had the virus many months ago, and some people have come into contact with the virus in the time leading up to them travelling, and it only presents itself when they're tested here.
I'm just trying to find, I know that there was an infringement notice that was issued, I believe it was last week, for flight crew, I thought it was, for a Singapore flight. Was that in relation to one of those repatriation flights?
No, my understanding, Katie, that there was an infringement noted issued for two Canadian pilots who had flown Singapore to Darwin, who had were meant to be in quarantine. They were bringing, I understand, some of those firefighting aircraft out to Australia. That's my understanding.
That was a little while ago, but then I thought there was one on Friday last week as well. I'll just see if I can find that information. But I guess the point that I'm getting to is, we know from Melbourne, and we certainly know from South Australia and other locations, how important it is that we're getting everything right. And I suppose for me, I think the AusMat team does a phenomenal job out there at Howard Springs. Nobody could dispute that. I think that we've done, we've been doing a really good job here in the Territory. But as those increased numbers come back on those flights, the worry is that we may see more of those cases, and then that the possibility of it spreading to other locations increases. So I know that we're doing everything we can to try to ensure that that doesn't happen, but that would be the concern from the wider community.
Katie, and the AusMat team, they've been into highly environments where it's been highly infectious when they got everyone off those cruise ships. So they've learned those lessons from that. The facility out there, in a sense, lends itself to quarantining. They can talk, keeping some distance between people. They can be on their balcony and the staff can be on the footpath, things like that. Whereas if you're in a hotel type environment, someone's propped a door open, that close contact. So
can, as Katie mentioned, can we do more to stop the virus coming on these planes? Like you said, they're tested and then they're screened. Could we do more at the very start to stop the virus getting into Australia? Because like Katie said, I know AusMat do a great job, but if it's the more cases we get, the more chances are of it actually getting into the community, and that's what we don't want. And they've done a great job at containing that, but it's a risk and it's a very contagious virus. So can the government do more at the very beginning? That's my question. I think people are generally concerned about that.
Yes, and we continue to work with the Commonwealth Government and through their Department of Health and through DFAT and AusMat have provided what is the most practical steps in terms of having the least exposure, because obviously if we send Australians in, then we have to get them home. So how can we work with those authorities on the ground to do that pre-screening and get these people home safely? And lessons learned. You know, we've been doing this, as I said, we've got 1,300 people home. As the virus continues to evolve and we see it particularly in the northern winter, you know, the case numbers each day are just getting bigger and bigger. And so certainly any changes that could be made, we'd certainly work with the Commonwealth to consider those.
The week that was for Kalano Community Association, an Aboriginal-owned NDIS provider offering disability support services from the Top End to Tennant Creek. Mix 104.9.
You are listening to Mix 104.9's 360 and, well, plenty to cover off on today. As we know, the Territory, or the government, released earlier this week the Territory Economic Reconstruction Commission's final report, which has got an ambitious goal of making the Territory a $40 billion economy by 2030. Now, the Commission has identified priority industries that are critical to grow our economy, attract private investment and create jobs. They include energy, including renewables and gas for manufacturing, resources and agribusiness, tourism, defence and maritime, as well as digital and space industries. Now, the government says that they're acting quickly to implement these recommendations by establishing the Investment Delivery Task Force, implementing a red tape reduction action plan, including reducing the timeframe for standard business approvals to 30 days and investing in renewables infrastructure and water supply infrastructure in the budget. Now, it all sounds, the report is actually, you know, the report seems good. It seems like a really good roadmap. The main thing that I'm hearing, though, on this show is that people are worried that the government isn't going to be able to implement and follow through with what they have put or what has been put into that report.
Yeah, so, Katie, the report's been released, and ultimately we think that you don't really need an expert panel to tell us that we need resources and mining to develop the Territory's economy. You know, really, the Gunner government could have done that themselves and not wasted the 8 or 9 months it took to get this report happening. So, effectively, we think the whole report was a waste of time. The people who did the report were good, and they had some really solid people doing the report, but the government had enough initiative to do that report themselves and come up with the recommendations. So, effectively, really now it needs to be acted upon, not just sat on the shelf and get dust. And I read the report, and there's a whole pages and pages of what to do and what success looks like. So now we've really got these KPIs, you could call them, to say 2 years, 5 years and 10 years. So the government has set themselves up, and now we know what the report says and what it should be done to get there. So is it going to happen?
Well, that's a big if.
Yeah, but was that one of the criticisms from opposition earlier this week, though, is it lacked KPIs?
Well, it lacked KPIs, but it does say, when you read through it, what success looks like. And I know they're very broad and motherhood statements, but that's what's all it's got.
Yeah.
So the KPIs are very poor, but there is something there at least we can use.
Yeah, look, I think the big thing is, and certainly Andrew Liver has said this to us when we interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, that there needs to be a real change of mindset in the way in which we do business in the Northern Territory in terms of well, getting things moving more quickly than we ever have before. And that's something that we've really struggled with. You know, there's a real perception, whether it's right or wrong, there is a real perception that the public service can take quite a long time in terms of getting those approvals through. Now, all you need to do is look at the mining sector over the last few years to be able to see that. You know, 4 years, I think it is, on average, to get a mine approved, whereas you look across to WA and it's 250 days. So it's a real, you know, it certainly makes it quite difficult, especially when you consider the fact that we are going to be competing with other states and territories to really try and kickstart our economy. Everyone's in a very similar situation at the moment.
So, Katie, the report is a blueprint to kickstart our economy for that economic rebound in the Territory. We need to make sure that we're agile and more responsive. We don't want to cut corners. We know that there is important processes that have to take place, but you can still do that in a far more agile, responsive way. So that report is there. The Chief Ministers ask Chief Executives to come back with a plan on how we implement that. So rather than traditionally,
how long do they have to come back with that plan?
He's saying that he'd like that done early in the new year. And so rather than this accepting the recommendations and then people slowly work away from them, we want to see the innovation led from the chief executives of the agencies to say, okay, this is what the report is saying we should do for this economic rebound. And it's a real diversity of economic opportunities there. Yes, there is mining and gas, but there's also tourism. There's also the renewables opportunities. So there's a wonderful chance for the Northern Territory, particularly rebounding from COVID and keeping us safe, we've got that opportunity to shift our energy and enthusiasm.
And if those chief executives don't come back with some, you know, with some really good plans come January next year, what's going to be the outcome?
We need to have chief executives that are agile, that are responsive. I'm really privileged that the chief executives I work with are innovative and they have that sense of urgency. But that's what we need to see in the leadership, not only from the government, but also from the chief executives who head up those agencies.
So are they on notice?
Our chief executives, they certainly know that they're on notice in terms of sticking to the budgets that we've set them and the opportunity to be innovative and stepping forward as we step out of COVID and the economic opportunities we have.
The problem with the report, there are no time frames in it. And it talks about the reducing approvals down to 30 days. But what businesses, Natasha, have you actually got approvals or business that you are going to bring the 30 days into?
So what we found is that we set time frames that businesses need to get forms and complete paperwork
but
with
what
us.
Businesses?
Across a variety of applications, they have so many days to lodge it. And then when it comes back to government, there's no parameters around government to actually be responsive. And so something, you know, that might not actually be complete that needs some more information, it'll sit there and go through a process. And business gets very frustrated because they could have provided that information far earlier on. So it's actually pushing some onus back onto the public service. When you receive those forms, they can't just sit there and slowly go through a process. You need to be agile and responsive.
Why have we gotten to the point where it's like that? Why has it gotten to the point where some business think that the public service is this behemoth that's there to stop them from starting rather than help them to get changes implemented and to get moving?
I'm not sure, Katie, but that's certainly the mindset that we need to change. We need to, you know, the public service is full of passionate people who are smart and we need them in key areas. We certainly need their support and their oversight and community has that expectation. We need to respect them for that, but we need business to understand that the public service is working with them. They're holding them to account, but they're not necessarily working against them, which is sometimes the perception you get now.
100%. But then I don't think it helps when changes are made like the public holidays last Friday, where then, you know, business owners kind of go, well, hang on a second. On one hand, the government's telling us that they want to help us and they want to, you know, they want to make our lives easier and they're there to support us. They need us to lead the way through this economic crisis. But then they also give us 30 days notice, you know, on a massive change that's going to cost them a lot of money.
And ultimately, which businesses is the 30 days going to apply? Is it going to be the mining sector? Is it going to be the agricultural sector? Because the Ghana government really need to show some leadership here. They've got a report, they've got a blueprint, and now it's time to act and show some true leadership.
Well, and the big issue is, to go back to it, and I said this to Nicole Manison the other day when she was on the show. I've certainly said it to Michael Gunner. We've got a situation where the last 4 years really haven't shown the track record of getting things moving as quickly as what we need. And I think that's where we've got to see some serious change. And it's one thing to say that, you know, that we've got to have that mindset change. It's you know, one thing to say that those chief executives have been put on notice, but I'm fairly sure they'll put on notice as well for the Langlandt review.
Mm. And that's what I said in my comments. The chief executives, they know that they need to stick within their budget and that work has certainly been done, but we also need them to be responsive and what they're delivering has to be to grow the territory economy. We need to have, as I've said, we need to have a smart public service. We need to make sure that the community's interest is held up, but at the same time, they need to be responsive for that business and the economic opportunities it generates.
Do you believe that the $40 billion economy by 2030 is possible? Because it's a long way within 10 years, and even the chief himself in a press conference earlier this week described it as ambitious.
It is very ambitious, but the opportunity we've just spoken about here in terms of energy, we've got both gas but also the opportunity through renewables, the tourism, defence and marine, and then also the digital opportunities. Like we have so much opportunity here for the territory. Now is the time to nail it so we can have that economic prosperity and, coming back to your point, nail that ambitious goal of a huge economy.
We need the business community telling us that they need action now. No more talk, no more rubber stamping, no more beating around the bush. They want action now. They need to get the economy happening. We've had COVID, who's hurt a lot of people socially and economically. No more talk. They need action.
And I think that we certainly, that message has come across loud and clear, but what COVID's shown us that we can be responsive if we do need to be and that we can step forward. And so that's certainly the lessons learned from working in a COVID environment.
But the Boxing Day holiday, for example, there was no public consultation about that. It was just pandering to the union mates and here's a deal with 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. they're on the front steps of Parliament out ripping up the budget, and now they've got an extra day holiday. And really, ultimately, what's going to hurt? The casual people aren't going to get the work. The full-time staffers are going to have to fill in and do extra work, so it's not going to help these people. They're going to, effectively, have less money in their pay that week.
The Boxing Day holiday, we're one of three jurisdictions, I think, from memory, that have that opportunity, that hadn't recognised it as a public holiday.
Those other opportunities, they've got 2 days for one as well.
This is, in terms of, you know, frontline workers, this is nurses, this is fireys, this is acknowledging that the day that they're working means that they have to have a different Christmas day so they can get out there and care for Territorians.
Do you accept, though, it's really difficult for some of those businesses finding out 30 days before that public holiday, or just over sort of 30 days before that public holiday, that then, you know, if they hadn't already planned to either close for that day, or if they hadn't already factored in that it was going to cost them X amount of dollars in wages, that it's a really big added expense for them at short notice on what's been a really tough year?
So frontline staff, hospitality staff, I saw one local outlet talking in the NT News that they actually want to acknowledge their staff who've worked really hard this year. When it is public holidays, that surcharge can come into place, and so that provides for the ability to pay extra.
So you reckon most of them are happy? You reckon most of those businesses are actually happy with the change?
I wouldn't say that whether it's a matter of happy or unhappy, but I think businesses accept that they've got staff that are working a day after Christmas, which means that their staff have to have a different Christmas to other people, and it recognises that hard work.
If you were thinking about this, why don't you consult with industry? You know, it's not just you wake up in the morning and go, we're going to have a public holiday. It's obviously in the pipeline. Why don't you go out and get their views before you made the decision?
So it comes back under that legislation. Boxing Day, it falls on that first day, but there is the ability, and as we've seen previously, and other jurisdictions have done this, for it to be declared the actual day of public holiday.
Look, the really tough thing, I think, at the moment is, in my opinion, there seems to be a divide which is building between the public service and the private sector. And I said this on air throughout the week. I spoke to Nicole Manison about it as well and said that, you know, if you talk to private sector workers after this year, a lot of them have taken pay cuts. Some of them have lost their jobs. Some of them have had to reduce their hours and have struggled through what's been a really difficult year. Now, we all understand that those frontline public service workers have done a phenomenal job. You know, looking at our police officers, our health workers, they've done a tremendous job. But the issue at the moment is when you've still got a pay increase for your public sector ahead of an election, and then you come out and announce, you know, that they've got, well, there's going to be the public holiday changes, which is going to quite severely impact some business people. I think what the government needs to recognise is that there is quite a divide which is building between the private sector and the public sector, and I think we've got to be really careful on this, particularly if we're then relying on the private sector to be the ones that help us bounce back after COVID. They need to be supported, and we need to actually, you know, try our best to make things a little bit more, I wouldn't say easy is the right word, but to support them a little bit more, I guess, in what's been such a tough year.
Because I think business are really counting on the government, Ghana government, to show some leadership. And unfortunately, over the last 4.5 years, there's been no leadership. And look where we are now. We've gone from $1.8 billion debt up to $8.4 billion debt. We've got the forecast of getting more and more. And it's just been no leadership. And the business out there are really hurting. And the report says that it really needs a private industry-led recovery, yet private industry aren't getting the support they need. In fact, they're getting more handbrakes by an extra public holiday, which costs them more money.
Katie, I would disagree. I think that what we've seen this year is that the Northern Territory, through the leadership that comes from the public service, has been able to shine, and I certainly get feedback from businesses that have been able to stay open and trade in a relatively normal sense because the measures that we've listened to, that public health expert advice, we've listened to our public service. So I think that we need to understand that the public service aren't just people that sit around and walk the carpet, that they're hardworking people across a range of areas.
I don't think anyone's disputing that, because you guys do that very often. And also, though, the thing I think that the government does really well at the moment is whenever you're questioned about the public service, or whenever you're questioned about anything to do with crime, you guys draw it back to, you know, saying that we're not supporting the public service, or saying that we're not supporting police in these different areas. That's purely not the case. You know, all that I'm saying is at the moment we're creating a bit of a divide between the public sector and the private sector. And I think that if it's not sort of acknowledged, or if if we don't try to stop that from happening in some ways, it might make it tougher for us to recover than what we're hoping it does.
So what I was about to highlight was, say, it's people, for example, putting innovative tourism marketing campaigns to come together to get people into the territory that then book on those mums and dads small business tour operator businesses. It's people that are making sure, as much as we want to open up the economy in terms of mining and gas, we need to protect the environment. We've heard that loud and clear from Territorians. And so it's actually understanding what the public service is and those individual roles right across a broad range of areas. And they certainly work very hard, and they do work cohesively with the private sector. We've seen that.
Why are we in a situation where we've had to do a review to tell us how we need to recover and how we need to move faster? If it's all been working beautifully, why did we need to go down this path?
So in terms of what I was about to finish off on was, in terms of the hospitality sector, they had their annual meeting and their end of year lunch, and they had police there, they had public health officials there, they had licensing, because they acknowledged that those public servants have listened to their concerns, they've been agile, they've been responsive. But what this report is, this is an ambitious body of work that shows us the key areas which I outlined before around mining and renewables and agribusiness and defence and data, the opportunities we have in the territory to grow our economy so that we can be a standalone economy. We acknowledge that we see a significant amount of our funding, percentage of our funding comes from the Commonwealth. We do need to step away from that. So the Langland report was around the structural budget of the NTG agencies, and this report is around how we can grow our economy.
But if you look at what the police association said back in June, I think 90% of their members were saying that they're poor or extremely poor the way that the government handle the law and order issues. So really there is a divide between the public service, who do a great job, and the leadership, or the lack of leadership, that Gunner is showing in, because even these services, their own surveys are saying that there is no leadership.
You are, of course, listening to Mix 104.9's 360. It is The Week That Was. And yes, in with us this morning, we've got Gerard Maley, Maddie Hepworth and Natasha Files. It is just on 20 minutes away from 10 o'clock. It is, of course, Friday morning. It is The Week That Was. I've got Gerard Maley, Maddie Hepworth and Natasha Files in the studio. Now, we've been speaking a lot recently about the levels of crime in Alice Springs. We've also spoken, or it was raised with me earlier in the week, that there's been issues in Malden. We know that late last week I spoke to a mum who was actually in the rural area, who had people break into her home. They were in the rooms while her children slept in those rooms. There is no doubt that there's a lot of people that listen to this show, and a lot of people within the Territory community who are quite concerned about what I would call really, I don't know how you'd describe it. It's really bloody useless. Not that any crime is useful, but it's really, it's a lot of heartache. For very little return, I think you'd say. People smashing windows. There was somebody drove through a fence in a home in Mille Lacs, I believe it was, during the week, and stole a car. But Alice Springs, you would have to say, has really reached the point which, I had somebody email us earlier in the week who said that he's lived there for 48 years and he's never seen it as bad as what it is now. I know that throughout the week, the Chief Minister, the Police Minister, the Minister for Territory Families, were all in Alice Springs. Natasha, did they go out with the police at night? What types of things have they done while they've been there?
So the Minister for Territory Families, she's certainly been out on patrol with police. I'm not sure of the ministers, what their specific meetings and what activities they undertook were there, but we've seen Strike Force Viper and the work that's been done, and we've certainly the police ministers extended that to have a permanent base. Operation Luna's been set up to address this youth-based crime that we're seeing, but it's also the youth drop-in centre has had a trial of 24 hours. So
7 days a week yet, or still just 3 days a week?
I'm not sure of the length of days, but certainly looking at, because it's not only about making sure police have got their resources and that there's the appropriate programs, youth diversion back on track, all of that we've spoken about extensively. I don't need to keep going over that. But it's also about making sure that we've got activities to keep these young people engaged. And then there's the work around housing and appropriate accommodation,
etc. I will say, we have put in a request to have the Territory Families Minister on the show on Monday morning. We put in a request, I believe it was yesterday as well, to see if we could have her on the show.
that it's not. They just can't find the police, and they call the police, and they take ages to show up, and the crime is out of control. And more importantly, the criminals know it's easy, because they just get catch and release out the door, and they do it again because it's fun and they're bored. These are the things that are really genuinely upsetting people right across the territory, not just in Nelson, but in Alice Springs, in Katherine and Tennant, Palmerston, in the northern suburbs. People have had a gutful, and it really it's time for action and not just talk.
Now, Falsey, I'm not expecting you to have the answers to these questions, but I know some of the questions that have been asked, because we were told how many briefs have been provided by the Territory Police. I can't think of the correct wording for it, but I know that some of the questions that have been asked, particularly in Alice Springs, is how many of those youths have been arrested, how many of those youths were bailed, how many of those youth offenders have been refused bail, how many youth offenders are in the care of Territory families that have been arrested, how many of those offenders were given a verbal or written warning, and how many of them were arrested for new offending while on bail. Jared, you mentioned this, and it's, again, it's something that we've spoken about on numerous occasions. Is it time for us to re-look at those bail laws, Filesy?
So just coming back to a point that Jared raised, in terms of, I know the police commissioner has been doing a lot of work around exactly what's the best model of policing and where should police be based to deliver the services to Territorians. So you see different task force, you see different operations, and you see general duties. He's been doing operational work around that. So
I think we all agree that the police themselves do a marvellous job.
But he's been looking at that structure and how best that can serve the community. The figures that I've got, Katie, is in terms of Strike Force Viper. So since the inception of Strike Force Viper, and I apologise if you've already read these out on air, but there's been 217 prosecutions submitted.
What
does that mean?
So, and of that, there's 122 were for property offences, and of that, 106 youth were prosecuted. It doesn't mean that some weren't prosecuted. It's 106 individuals, as I understand.
So tell us again how many were prosecuted?
So 217 prosecutions submitted for offences, and property offending is 122 of those, and the youth prosecuted was 106. But that could be multiple charges. So Strike Force Viper certainly got down into Alice Springs. They've done that work, and they are certainly working through those files and providing support to the community, but there is more work to go.
To lay it out on the line for our listeners, of those 106 that were prosecuted, does prosecution mean that they could either, you know, be remanded, they could be spending time in a youth detention facility, they could be out on bail? There's lots of different...
It's 106 youth are being... one youth could be charged with multiple incidents, so it's not 106 different individuals, but 100 of those, they are going through the justice system, yes, as you just read that out, Katie.
But so we...
And can you give us the numbers then of how many individuals are there?
I don't have that information before
but this is the third time we've asked these questions in September. There's a press
release.
We've
got estimates in a couple of weeks.
You're going to be getting asked these questions, and we expect some answers, because that'll be the fourth time that we've asked for the answers, and you haven't given them. The numbers are there. They're pretty easy to get. There must be something you're hiding.
I must say, as a journo, I do struggle to wrap my head around the different ideas about, you know, prosecution files.
And I think that's the whole point. I feel as though the government's trying to confuse us.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be blunt about it, I promise. And I was just about to read out.
But to be blunt about it, I feel like that is the aim. Like, I feel like you're being, not you, because I know it's not your portfolio, but I feel as though that's been the aim, to be vague.
It's like, one question is a really straightforward question. How many youths get charged for a new offence whilst on bail?
So, Katie, there's a range of initiatives in place, which we've spoken around. There's the youth justice conferencing and victim support. There's the support of bail. Yeah. There's alternative sentencing. And we've talked about the range of programs.
And that's the answers that I'm keen to get from the Minister for Territory Families. So if you're able to let her know that we want her on the show on Monday,
Wolfie.
We have made sure that we've put that request in, but they're the answers that we want. You know, like, they're the types of things that we actually want to know the answers to. And that's what the community is screaming out for.
There is a range of options and programs.
But at the moment, the community feels a bit concerned that, you know, the term that I hear so often, I think this is why it's really important that we get some of those details, is that it's catch and release. That's the term that I hear from listeners. That's not my term. That's not made up by me. So I think it's really important that people realise.
That's the term that people come into my office are saying to me, and they're really generally concerned that these youths out there running amok and the police are trying to do a best job they can, but they're lacking resources, they're lacking leadership from the Gunner government.
And that's why, again, I reckon it's just so important. If we can get some of those numbers, if people can know, you know, how many people have gone out to 7 EMU Station, how many people have done that victim conferencing and those real, you know, detailed, I guess, numbers. We don't need to know the details of the different offenders. That's obviously the type of information that we're not allowed access to. But I think if we can get some of those details, it will make Territorians understand, hopefully, that, you know, that we are actually dealing with youths in the appropriate ways.
And explain what diversion is. People say, oh, youths go through diversion. But what does that mean? The average person out there doesn't understand what that means. Are they out cleaning up or are they sitting at home playing Xbox? I don't know.
I've got no idea. I've got less idea than you, Jared, that's for sure. We better take a very short break. You are listening to Mix 104.9's 360. It is just 10 minutes away from 10 o'clock. I apologise. I think we went off air for a moment there, but everything's been back on for a little while. If you're listening to us online, we wouldn't have gone off air, but apparently we did just for a moment. I think we had an issue with the transmitter.
The week that was for Kalano Community Association, an Aboriginal-owned NDIS provider offering disability support services from the Top End to Tennant Creek. Mix 104.9.
It is just 7 minutes away from 10 o'clock, and of course it is the week that was. Now, before we wrap up this morning, I know that the ABC is reporting, and Robin Lamley joined us on the show yesterday morning to talk about this. The ABC is reporting that drug and alcohol services supporting people on parole in the Territory will lose program funding at the end of the month, sparking concern from the sector. That is according to a leaked letter from the Health Minister, Natasha Files, is what's being reported this morning. Now, the grant funding, worth $1.9 million, covered beds at 5 residential facilities and counselling support in Darwin, Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, and was introduced as part of the 2017 parole reforms aimed at addressing the Northern Territory's high incarceration rates. Now, the ABC has confirmed that the funding will expire at the end of December, with the government blaming the economic impact of COVID-19 for the decision not to renew the funding in last month's budget. Well, if we didn't do that public holiday on Friday last week, I think that's costing us $1 million, isn't it, for our public servants? So it could have gone towards those programs.
Yeah, this just shows that the Gunner government are going soft on crime. You know, we all know that alcohol and crime go hand in hand, and now they're going to cut this. And they talk about it's CLP, a party of cuts. Well, the Labor government are cutting, cutting, cutting.
Well, Falsey doesn't want to cut it by the sound of this letter.
So, Katie, the Department of Health, they fund alcohol and other drug rehabilitation services, and we're the primary funder of those services across the Territory. In terms of if it's a prisoner, correctional services, they fund the programs that prisoners undertake, and so they'll continue to prepare prisoners for their parole and release.
And so will there still be some kind of rehabilitation in terms of that alcohol and other drugs for them?
That would be a question for the Attorney-General.
Yeah. But obviously it is incredibly important. I mean, the big thing that we talk about all the time when we talk about people going to, whether it's, you know, through adult corrections or youth corrections, is that we want them to come out better people, not better offenders. And I think that this is really the heart of that.
And Katie, I don't have the information around the results from these programs. We certainly acknowledge that there needs to be a wide variety of programs for prisoners to undertake so that they can rehabilitate and come back into our community a better person and be meaningfully participating in the community. But in terms of alcohol and other drugs, Health fund alcohol and other drug services across the Territory with NGO providers to provide support. It would be a question for corrections. What other programs will prisoners be able to access whilst they're in prison to prepare them for their release?
So could it be that they somehow are able to access some of those health programs, or is that, no, that would not be the case?
So the health, we fund alcohol and other drug programs across the Territory for the community to have those programs to participate in, messaging, etc. In terms of prisoners, that's a responsibility of corrections, what programs people participate in when they are a prisoner.
You remember the Gunner government gave $12 million to the grandstand for 8 week or 10 weekends a year, and yet they're cutting these services day in, day out, are generally needed by these people. These people need help, and the programs are being cut.
I'd be really really interested to know, like, how many people have gone through the program. I know you don't have that figure, Natasha, but I'd be really interested to know how many people have actually used that program while they've been going through the corrections, you know, going through corrections, and how successful it's been.
And the commit program generally helps people on parole. I understand it's you know, commit is about where if you do a breach, you go in and you get in, go inside for 1 or 2 days. And remember, if you breach parole normally, you go back inside for the rest of your sentence. You might be a year or 6 months.
The commit program operates independently to this commit funding, is my understanding.
Okay. All right, we might have to get the corrections minister on about that. I tell you what, it's been a busy morning, it always is, and that's it for us this morning. I'm still on for another 2 hours, but Jared Maley...
You're getting rid of us, Wolfie.
Getting rid of you. Deputy Opposition Leader, thank you for your time.
Thank you, everybody.
And Maddie Hepworth, we'll talk to you again very shortly to get the latest in local news. Thank you.
Thanks, Katie.
And Natasha Files, the Minister for Health and Tourism, but we'll still ask you questions about every portfolio and hope for the best. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to talk about the mighty Mix 104.9. And Nightcliff Tigers.
Oh, I know.
They've got another home game under lights tomorrow night. So very exciting. The community really got out and supported the last game. The boys didn't quite get the win.
It was all great except the result.
The Southern District rural people.
But go the boys.
A really important message. The under-10s are playing at half-time.
Oh,
so we need all the parents to be there at 7 o'clock.
That's a great idea. They do that in the NRL in Queensland as well. It's a really good thing that they do at the Cowboys games. They have all the young kids go out and play at half-time. I think it's a great thing.
So if you're a Tigers under 10 AFL parent, you need to have your children at Nightcliff Oval at 7 p.m.
There you go.
I've done my community service broadcast.
I was going to say, that's our Filesy's community service announcement there. Thank you all so very much for your time this morning. We'll catch you again, next week, some of you. Mix 104.9.